Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NavaZoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Gary is following Mary's telling of how they got sober a week later. And Mary did tell us earlier that Gary had long pants on, but he did have sandals. He was wearing his sandal. The first time I laid eyes on Gary N., he had driven Bill Roop to NABA, and I probably had a 10 days sobriety at the most, and the whole club was going, you know, Bill and Gary are coming, Bill and Gary are coming. I'm like, Bill and Gary? And they're like, oh, you won't believe this, you won't believe this. Bill Root comes marching in, and Gary was right there as sidekick. And I was like, God, Lord, these guys got it together. And we had a humdinger of a meeting. It was a wonderful meeting. I don't know if Phil was that meeting or not, but Bill Root was a discussion leader not too long afterwards, and he was well into his 80s. And he gets up and sits on that desk cross-legged. At 80-something years old, as limber as anybody I've ever seen, Gary had a hard time keeping up with Bill. But anyway, I go on too long. I'm sure Gary will tell us a little more about that.
My name is Gary Neithart, and I'm an alcoholic. And welcome to this issue of Point Counterpoint, now that I'm following my lovely wife. Thanks for the introduction, Tim. You know, for demographics, I had a sponsor within 30 days of coming into the program, and Bill was actually my third sponsor. Wayne Vermilia was first, John Holmes in 1999, Bill Roop in 2001, John Cornelius in 2013, and John Thomas since 2014. And, you know, and there's a lot of years there. Bill Roop died with 56 years. And, you know, something that he never ever mentioned, but I will, and, you know, to honor him, is he was sponsored by Art Hodes. The last name is H-O-D-E-S. And if you look that up, Art Hodes and the All-Stars, you're going to find a jazz pianist that played with everybody. And there's quite a few DVDs of him as well, if you're interested. Well, Art Hodes was sponsored by Bill Wilson. That's a pretty short sobriety chain, but that's all because of Bill Roop, who came out of Chicago, and so did Art Hodes. But if you get sponsored by somebody who was came into the program in the 50s, as both Bill Roop and John Holmes did, then your sobriety tree can be that short. A few demographics is, you know, I'm born in 1972. I came into the program on August 25th of 1997. I'm in the slow class. You know, so I was just 49 when I came in, which means that if you do a little math with 23 years, I'm now 72. And you know, in the what I used to be like department, I'm reminded, so I can't remember who said, parents, where we suffer our first wounds, you know, and a lot of us end up having, for one reason or another, the way we grow up, what parents did or didn't do, and sometimes that can be a big deal. Some people, you know, with alcoholics like us, some people say we were born a quart low. I'll buy that. Another one says Clancy was, I just heard this one, it was reminded, I heard it before, we were born without any emotional insulation. You know, bingo, that kind of goes with the temper tantrums I used to have when I didn't get my way, when I was 7, 8, or 8 years old. There was a lot of conflict going on with a sister that was 7 years older than, destined to come into the program in 1978 to show you that she was in the fast class. Well, I wasn't, but when you're hearing a bunch of yelling come through the floor, we were put to bed at 8 o'clock and my sister was not obeying. My father was president of the school board and my sister was basically not wanting to go to school and there was all sort of chaos. But the kind of yelling that was going on when it comes through the floor and you can't see it, it has a way of having much more effect as even if you are present. And that was a big influence. Both my parents were extremely successful in whatever they tried to do. My dad was a Fortune 500 executive. He had offices in Cleveland and on Park Avenue in New York City. My mother ended up having master's degrees in psychology from the University of Columbia in 1939, in an era when a lot of women didn't have that much of an opportunity. And it's just out of 20 trivia is that when you walk from Central Park to the GSO, you walk right down West 116th Street, which I had been doing pretty regularly when I was visiting the GSO. I spent 10 days there in 3 different trips. And I was when I do that walk, I'm walking right by my mother's dormitory, which is kind of one of those small world routines. But very outstanding people. The first book that I wrote actually was my dad's letters to my mother during World War II. When he was in the Navy, and that turned out to be, it's that by itself is just, it's mainly a family story, but my dad being very much of a historian, there's other things that apply there. They moved to, after the war, they moved to Chagrin Falls, Ohio, home to Tim Conway, and because I'm from Chagrin Falls, Ohio, I could tell you his name was originally Tom Conway before it was changed, but, Chagrin Falls, you know, I'm therefore from Disappointment Falls from this nearby Cleveland, Ohio, which is also wise known as the Mistake by the Lake. So if you came from Chagrin Falls, Ohio, you drink too. You know, or at least that's the kind of thing that can go on in my head. This does to be so much of a disease of perception. You know, but one thing that can be very clear is regardless of how successful your parents are or aren't or whatever else, love can be spelled T-I-M-E or time. And on that basis, with all my father's success, I actually had 2 mothers, the other one being his secretary, my father's secretary. And you get through Mrs. Iben, that was the way that I could get to my dad. Very successful, wasn't around a lot, traveling into Europe, traveling all over the place, traveling to South America, but that goes with the success. But when you're goofy as I was, and you're looking for something to hang on to, all you know is there's a lot of success, but somehow I'm in the I don't have a clue class. Somehow, you know. But again, this is part of the nature of how we get into Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're anything like me, I make up stories. And then I fall for him. And I am a consummate con artist. And only upon coming into this program do I realize that some of the stories that I have been telling myself all these years are bunk. But you don't know that until you actually have to start telling people what those stories happen to be. And of course, with a sponsor, with the person that you end up sharing things that you never thought you'd ever share anything with. And even then, when you share whatever it happens to be, and you think it's so unusual, whatever it is, it doesn't turn out to be that way because the person sitting across from you has done twice as much of that or whatever it is than you thought they are. So in other words, a lot of times we make up this little box which describes who we think we are. Then it gets uncomfortable in the box. And who's to blame for that? I am, right? So part of our reason for sharing is to realize often we don't know what we're talking about. And often what we think we know will keep us drunk. So my heavens, how necessary that is. But all this is basically, you'll only find out about it through participation. So I consider myself to be a miserable failure when I got into college. I was on crutches. I never drank until I got to college, but I immediately found it that was something I wanted to do, but I ended up on crutches as a result of a drunk on my freshman year and then crutches my sophomore year, would you believe, in two different events. And by my junior year, that's when the Vietnam War vets showed up, and that changed everything. And when they brought in all of their different mood chemicals and everything else, I entered into the glow in the dark period. That was also an era of controversy. It was nuts, but I really liked all of those mood changers. And I swear we could stay up all night doing whatever happened to be with whatever happened to be available to us. And for me, I ended up having a party room. And to give you an idea of how late we could stay up and how little I went to class, and the class happens to be in my senior year at Ohio Wesleyan, is that I hadn't been to class in 2 weeks, thought it would be a good idea to go there with a buddy of mine who was in the class too. And so we went down to campus and the building wasn't there anymore. And you know, what in the world do you do then? I mean, that's how out of touch we were. But in retrospect, there's the C.S. Lewis quote, "I now see that I spent most of my life doing neither what I ought nor what I liked." And that's exactly the way I remember those days, as crazy as they were. You know, but it was very much a time of crazy. In December 1969, I won the lottery, the draft lottery, the only lottery I've ever won. I was drafted on June 7th in 1971, and to make a long story short, the draft law expired on June 30th of 1971, and so did I. And, with time running short already, I'll just say that if you've ever followed the TV show MASH, I ended up doing a clinger. I weirded myself out of the United States Army. I really want to admire anybody that served. I don't want to, in any way be critical. Those people should be honored in every way. But, I was at one time was in Air Force ROTC and was going to be a pilot. Then the war changed my mind, but then the government changed my future for me when it drafted me, and I didn't like it. That was just part of the controversy. Fortunately, after I went AWOL, I was put in touch with a family friend, a child psychologist that was in Dallas, Texas, and he wrote me up to the United States Army, and I got a violin. I used to play the violin, and that was my teddy bear, and he using that as a prop and being able to rock back and forth and mimic being a schizophrenic, which he counseled me on. Also, he wrote a letter to the United States Army saying I was a hetero-homo masturbative sexual schizoid. And I got out of the Army for unsuitability, which is under medical conditions, and is an honorable discharge. All right. And boy, was I happy to get out of that. But at the same time, when I was incarcerated after I turned myself in, I got a Dear John letter. It was from the female that I thought, She lived where the sun rose, and I met her in my senior year in high school. And, you know, we ended up going to 4 years of university together. And I used to, you know, here's good exercise in self-pity. Go to bed at night feeling that you've been rejected. So I came up with this scenario. I wonder where I'll be the day that she gets married. Doesn't that hit you? I mean, you know, it's pointless, but I mean, that's what I did, you know, and no matter how much time I spent on that, I never came close to being the right answer. She married my brother, and they've been married as of next December for 49 years. All right. So it would have been just one more divorce. And it's a good example of how things work out when God's in charge and not me. You know, after the Army, I was in the single and searching. I went to work actually for my father's company with some of my credentials. That would seem to be the easier, softer way. But then I was a heavy cigarette smoker. I could smoke pot anywhere, carry a pipe in your suit coat, and, you know, and go into the bathroom and toke up and then put your thumb over the top of the pipe and then go out of the men's room and breathe out air slowly. I could do that anywhere and did. But I mean, after work, drank very heavily in downtown Cleveland. You know, and this is one of those things when you're an alcoholic or a heavy drinker, you often put yourself places in a place where you might be harmed. And so that's why, you know, I was actually up in Ann Arbor just helping out a fellow in a beer carryout. And that's when I was held up with two butcher knives. Actually, the cashier was, and I just happened to be standing too close to him. That turned out to be a court case. I don't think I was a good witness because I was stoned. I did was stoned for everything, incidentally, back then. And even when I left the job in Cleveland and late at night, heavy drinking, that was in 1977. I was held up at gunpoint. But I will say that you've been held up both at night point and in gunpoint. It will change your perception of where to be at what time. And a lot of times, you know, it's the alcohol leads you to be in places that you really shouldn't be at all. That was a lesson. In 1976, my mother was diagnosed with kidney stones. And back then, that was a pretty serious diagnosis. So my brother and I went to the hospital you know, just after work and to see what the result of the operation was. And we walked into the lobby of this hospital, and my father met, you know, here's this successful father. He's 60 years old. And for the first time in my life, 1976, he was drunk as a skunk. You know, he comes along and says, what a wonderful woman your mother is, blah, blah. You don't treat her right, blah, whatever. You know, and my brother gets us away from this. And he goes over to check where my mother is. And so it turns out that my father was too drunk to know that there hadn't been a kidney operation, that my mother was okay, but he was too drunk to know it. Bingo. Executive or not, this was trouble. And what happened was, I mean, literally, that man, alcohol is an equal opportunity destroyer. It doesn't care what you've got or how much you what car you drive or anything else. It just, if he so much as smelled alcohol, he was a mess. So I participated in the first intervention, which is in my father's executive office. I walked in there with my brother, last to go in. We didn't say a word, and we just watched the intervention, you know, and as interventions go, he was not to get sober for for 11 years, 10 or 11 years, and he got sober at the age of 70. Grateful for the last 10 years of his life as well, but that was my first introduction to Al-Anon, you know, which at the time when I went to Al-Anon meetings, there were 22 ladies and two guys, and I was already happy with the woman I was dating at the time. And I was also stoned, so my spiritual progress didn't go very far in Al-Anon, you see. I didn't get a whole lot of it out there, but I started to learn what Al-Anon was all about. And I ended up moving to Rhode Island to get away from the circus, my father's circus. And our relationships improved a great deal when I did. When I moved, incidentally, and this is just something that happens over in retrospect, is that when I moved, I went for a company by the name of Amtrol in Warwick, Rhode Island. The head of the company at that time was named Chet Kirk. And it turns out to be Chet Kirk was an alcoholic, and he was the one that bought Dr. Bob's coffee pot, and that happens to be at Brown University. It's just one of those things that you learn after the fact that the library, there's a library there that is naturally named after him. It's one of those small world routines. And I was at 3 years in Rhode Island, then 3 years in Massachusetts. You are looking at an honest to goodness real member of Cheers. Obviously that's just a TV show, but that the actual place was called the Hampshire House. The downstairs was called the Bullfinch Pub. And it was the real place was very cramped, small, brick, and crammed. And besides, any bar I ever went into, you couldn't talk over a bar. You were always crammed up with all the people, and you couldn't be crammed up with all the people. You'd never go there, right? But and incidentally, if you remember the theme song, everybody knows your name. Well, I went there for 3 years, and nobody ever knew my name. But that shows you the nature of that, you know. And then it was not long until I met my children's mother. I have been carefully, through sponsorship, learned to not refer to her any other way. All right. You know, but she came to work at my company. You know, we dated for a while. And she was also a salesman in the company that I worked for. And one time I was at a bar with her, and I told her that I was going to be meeting a particular lady that lived in Washington State, and I was going to be meeting that woman in Hawaii. And my she didn't like that news all that much. Took her glass, threw it against the wall. Of course, the glass smashes into a million pieces, and she starts screaming me at every single name that was in the book. So I don't like scenes and so forth. The management of the place tells us to get out. So I'm standing out in the middle of this, out in front of the restaurant, and son of a gun, she, boom, cold cocks me. And I go back like this, and who catches me but the police who took us away for protective custody. We weren't charged for anything. We had to have somebody come and pick us up. I've already given the punchline away. What do you do with a woman like that? You marry her. Of course you do. I mean, that's what I ended up doing. But that's, you know, and it is true. You can't make it up. I proposed to her in a bar. That's the name. It's in Merle's Inlet, and it's in South Carolina. It's the symbolism of the wisdom of that union. I proposed to her at Drunken Jack's. That's the name of the restaurant, bar and so on. So we always had the mutual habits. Our marriage was basically, she had the same habits that I did in terms of using and drinking and so forth. She was also a blackout drinker. Now, that's no big deal. No. You know, I knew that before I married her. It shows you how much I know. We did get three wonderful kids out of that, and we at that time we were living up in New Hampshire. The economy went very south up there, and we ended up moving to Atlanta in 1992. And when you ever uproot a family, some things might take, some things don't. You know, and we were very, very tied to that community up in Nashua, New Hampshire. Those ties were the same when we came down here. The venture capital company that that brought me down here went under after 3 years. That sent me more or less adrift. I sort of floated around looking for employment, but I was also getting quite depressed because my mood changer stopped working. You know, and I only in retrospect did I start to realize how depressed I was. I now know that looking back, I didn't know the dynamics of it, because I'd put my heart and soul into the product that had been in that most recent company. And then I got work in London for a good part of 1997. And what I didn't really know then is what I was giving my wife, the a practice of learning to live without me. And so, but when I came back from that in June, a number of events happened right in a row. My father died in June of 1997, which even made it more difficult. Job difficulties made it more difficult. And by towards the end of August, I ended up going to my first AA meeting. And, you know, because actually I was alone in my basement with a very angry wife. And, you know, I didn't have a friendly person to talk to. I didn't have any place to go. I did go to my first AA meeting on the 25th of August of 1997. I was served with the divorce papers on September 2nd, and I was I left the house on September 29th of 1997. And basically, it was because I got a sponsor that told me where I could land. I didn't have any idea where I was going to go. Was one of the first reasons, first things that a sponsor did for me. And another thing that was right off the bat with going through a divorce and a contested divorce, which lasted 2 years and 4 months, any time that I had to go into a courtroom, I never went in there alone. And that was also because I was in Alcoholics Anonymous and I had some people that had my back, including a sponsor, which always showed up and went with me. You know, it is a we program in every shape and form. There is never any shame in asking for help. The real shame turns out if we don't ask for help. You know, but nevertheless, you know, early sobriety can be so very difficult. It's been relatively recently I came across the concept of Dr. Tebow. And if you're anything like me with that desire to use, that desire to have my own way, the desire to control, the desire to change my mood on demand, that's called King Baby, which is actually, Dr. Tebow got that from Freud. I only recently learned. And, you know, and early sobriety for me is not that I am very special, not that I am a worm. My problem is I'm a special worm. But I'm also a recovering butthead. That's with one T. Far worse than the version with two T's. But you don't care. But you don't understand. But you don't know who I am. But if you knew me, you wouldn't like me. But. And what do you end up with in a set of circumstances like that? Here come healthy messages, and every one of them are going to bounce off my head. Why? Because I'm so busy looking at me, look at you, I can't even hear anything. That's my neighbor, nature of addiction. That's how I understand alcoholism. I am so selfish. I am so wrapped up in me. I'm so much in bondage. That's what bondage is. I can't even hear you. You know, and that the one thing I did right, I kept on coming back. And that's the key. Coming back. Because a healthy message sooner or later will penetrate my thick skull when I'm not looking. And then I'll go to a meeting and I'll end up feeling better. You know, and then I wonder how that ended up happening. I also bought the concept that sober fathers see their children. You know, it isn't necessarily true, but that's something that worked for me. And eventually, you know, God works in also in very strange ways. Also, because I can tell you about my weird episode with the United States Army and weirding myself out. Who would I go to work for and get a job immediately upon getting sober? But I became a contractor for the United States Army, and that's how I ended up making amends to the United States Army. Now, if you showed up at the Marshall Building Fort McPherson, and since I didn't have a security clearance, I had to be greeted at the front door, walked up to my place of work, and if I needed to go to the bathroom or leave my workstation, I had to call somebody to get me to do it because I wasn't allowed to run around the building without an escort. until I did get a security clearance, which took 11 months. But I did my first step with the U.S. Army. And I can tell you the version of doing steps 4 and 5 in the big book are a heck of a lot better than what they are. If you have to go to the, you do it to the U.S. Army, the guy said, I asked him, how long will this take? And he goes, I don't know, about maybe an hour. And 3.5 hours later, I got to leave him. And I had to sign every single dreary page that he wrote about me. But I got the security clearance, much to my amazement. So I started out making amends. And very quickly, if you're somebody who has a background, it becomes very clear for me that I am not somebody that can approach God intellectually. I have to see him with skin on. That's what sponsors are about. That's what going to meetings about. That's what getting involved with this fellowship and seeing how people have smiles on their face that wouldn't think of a drink or a drug. I'm really so grateful for that. And so, yes, in 2001, I did become Bill Roof's wingman, or more or less his driver. And what a hoot that was, because, Bill was relatively well known. I probably have 35 recordings of him, and he just had a magnet. He was just a magnet. So when we celebrated his 50th anniversary at a church with a party that Mary attended, it was the Norcross Church, Unity Church there. An hour before the party started, we didn't have a seat left, and we had 450 people in 450 seats. We packed 700 people into a place that sat 450. That's not a fish story, because that's what the reverend thought. And Bill Roop showed up and wore angel wings and a halo for that. I don't have time to tell you why. I also organized his 55th anniversary. Clancy came to the one in 2007. Tom Iverson came to the one in 2012. And we had a big, I don't know how many people we had for the 55th as well. But that was simply because of Bill. Bill could have a luncheon, Christmas luncheon, and have 40 men with 25 years average. There's nobody that I've known that has done that. But that's part of personal magnetism. That's part of what this program is capable of doing, with attraction rather than promotion. Again, in the middle of all this, I met Mary at a Valentine's Day dance that she didn't want to go to. I was chasing somebody else who I was not able to catch, and she happened to, there we were, and we got together the very next day, and we've been together ever since. And it's just one of those stories that you never know what might be around the corner, whatever blessing as a result of going to this. That was at a Valentine's Day dance. It was very unexpected. But it's just another blessing of this program, and it's also Bill Roop was my best man at my at Mary and my wedding, despite the fact that his wife had died 4 days before. And I had asked him, Bill, under the circumstances, you don't have to be my best man, and his response was, wild horses couldn't keep me away. That's what else is friendship, sponsorship, or what other example could you ever ask for than somebody like that? And when we, Mary and I would look at him at the during this event, and while he was there, the spark had just simply burned out of him, and very understandably so. But nevertheless, he was there. In 2013 is when I wrote the book that concluded the 115 letters to my father, and that got me in. And then in 2015, the book King Charles of New York City, which is, of course, the story of a very controversial fellow, Charles Towns at Towns Hospital. But, and, you know, it is not terribly well known that among his attributes was is that he financed half of the big book. That was $4,200 back in 1938 and 39, which is more or less the equivalent of $70,000 in today's money. Now, mind you, that was a loan. And, of course, without Towns Hospital, which he founded, and he hired Silkworth, without Towns, there wouldn't be a Silkworth. Without Silkworth, there probably wouldn't be a Bill Wilson. And when Bill Wilson got drunk, he would probably be had ended up at Bellevue Hospital or Knickerbocker Hospital, and we would probably have never heard of him. It's just one of those historical threads that was that discovered and is a story well worth telling. At the same time, you know, that got me in 2014, I became an archivist for the state of Georgia, Area 16. And for the Atlanta International, I was asked to do Georgia AA history. So I went down to Macon and started researching Georgia AA history. And very fortunately, we had this notebook down there, which are the letters which originated in Georgia and went up to the GSO, and then letters that came back. And I cataloged those letters. I have that catalog to this day. And very quickly, what I learned was that there was this woman up there by the name of Margaret Berger, Margaret Bobby Berger, because she was the one that was writing five of the six letters anyway, and as the general secretary of the GSO, which she was from 1942 to 1949. Now, I'd never heard of her, and to this day, most alcoholics in AA have never heard of her either. But that very much piqued my curiosity. And some may know that when we were doing face-to-face meetings at NABA on a Monday night, Tim was so gracious to invite me to do Atlanta AA history, which is a PowerPoint slide presentation which covers Bill Wilson's visits to Atlanta in 1942 and 1944, which I take credit for rediscovering because that information's lost and was not in Atlanta AA history that you would get from the central office. But again, the opportunity to do more research afterwards, and I kept on stumbling across Bobby Berger. So I asked permission of the AA Trustees Committee, the GSO Trustees Committee, for permission to come up and read the letters that Bobby Berger wrote from 1942 to 1949. I came away, I would dictate the letters when I was up there, and I came away with 1,000 of them. That is probably a 15% sample of the woman was a prolific writer. I was doing in the late fall and up, I was there in early March of this year before everything shut down. But since then, trying to do a little detective work online, I was able to make contact with relatives of Margaret Bobby Berger. And even though I've never met these people, I have gained their trust. And since it so turns out that they have a son-in-law, actually with Bobby Berger, that is her married name. We never even knew that she was married, but she had two daughters. And she also had six grandchildren. All right. And one of the son-in-laws of hers was sitting on literally a gold mine, a treasure chest, letters written anywhere from the 1920s either by her or to her. She turns out to be a dancer originally, a dancer, a professional dancer that went to Europe as a professional with a partner. Her husband died of a pneumonia in 1929. She remarried in 1932 to a very hard to get along with man. Then she started drinking and ended up in sanitariums for most of the late 1930s. But then she found Alcoholics Anonymous and was really part of AA being made into getting it out of its adolescent period. So what I'm going to read you is information that nobody in AA has read before, simply because these are the words of Bill Wilson describing Bobby Berger. I want you to remember that since I'm the only one who can have any real idea what your labor for AA meant to its infancy, just how much I appreciate and love you for that. And though the recent storms may have left you feeling unstrung and unfit, please always believe that you possess, down deep, the integrity and resources to meet any weather. That is a quality in which you have always inspired me and still does. I am sure you are destined for greater and happier usefulness than you have ever known. Please believe that of yourself it can come so true. Then there is your capacity for devotion, of which Lois and I and so many people had been the continuous receiver for years. Though in my case, your unanswering loyalty was so often undeserved, it is deeply appreciated just the same. Also believe that pain can be, and usually is, the price and touchstone of progress. I know it's hard to cling to that fact when suffering is intense and you feel done. This was written to her in 1949 after she had left employment in the GSO for having a nervous breakdown. But did you recognize? Here we go. Late 1949, that we have pain can be and usually is the price and touchstone of progress. That's step 10 out of the 12 and 12, and those are Bill's words 3 or 4 years before they emerged in the 12 and 12 and step 10. But then also getting to know Bobby, and this is words that he wrote, Bill Wilson wrote to somebody else about her. What I have to say this time is about Bobby Berger. You don't know her, but you ought to, for Alcoholics Anonymous will never record the deeds of a more devoted servant to our cause than hers in adolescence. She was my principal association at the foundation office. Few will ever comprehend what she did to make Alcoholics Anonymous what it is today, in unity and in numbers. 2 or 3 years ago, her health gave way under the strain. I think I told you about my conflict with the Board of Trustees. She was caught badly in that ringer through no fault of her own. They didn't hire enough help for the office, and the assignment got too tough for anyone to manage. Belatedly, many of them and many others are realizing how much we are in her debt. Those, again, are the words of Bill Wilson. And, again, these letters did not come from GSO archives. I can't be specific where they came from, but this is a brand new discovery, new Bill Wilson letters that nobody had seen before. And as the saying goes, I'll be amazed before I'm halfway through. This is part of the being amazed before I'm halfway through. There are lessons here also, though, because part of the reasons why nobody knows of her really is that she died in February of 1953, and it's now verified she did not die of a heart ailment, as was published in the grapevine. She took her own life, which is a tragedy. But there's a lesson here, and the lesson is uplifting, and it begins as this story started. Sponsorship. Sponsorship, sponsorship. She never had one. Bill was her only sponsor, and when she left employment at the GSO, she never found another sponsor. And just as I said, we're con artists. We make up stories. We fall for them. the stories can be fatal. This is a we program. This is not a me program. Over and over, I have to stay connected. We can do what I can. Boy, that is so true. It is so necessary to stay connected to Alcoholics Anonymous, not for the benefit of the Alcoholics Anonymous. I need AA. And if you're like me, yes, there is a solution. So let's trudge the road of happy destiny together. This turns out to be the best buzz there is. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Gary. He had that program that he described about Atlanta, AA with Bill Wilson coming to visit. There's a lot of great humor in some of the history that he presented. Comes across great if you were there, but the recording it came out good, and I think you'll enjoy it. It's on the 2019 page at the top of the page on aabluechipspeakers.org. If you haven't listened to it, it's a very fast 45 minutes, I promise you. Thank you, Gary. That was awesome.
There is a wall between us. We built it tall, like it that way. There is a fire pit beneath us. Keep it simple. We're made that way. There is a world of trouble. I need direction every day. Whenever the world busts my bubble, I fail to keep it simple every day. Keep it simple. Keep it simple, easy to let it go. Thank you.